From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. New York Times columnist David Brooks says that over the past few years, as a result of personal, national, and global events, he's become radicalized. In his new book, The Second Mountain, Brooks says he's come to realize that our hyper-individualized and self-obsessed culture has been a catastrophe, and that the key to joy and fulfillment lies in building relationships, surrendering to greater causes, and serving the common good. Coming up on Forum, we'll talk to David Brooks about his book and the latest news, and that's all next, after this. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 4 years ago, New York Times columnist David Brooks published The Road to Character, an examination of the virtues, like courage and grit, he considered necessary to lead a moral life. Now, David Brooks says that when he wrote that book, he was, as he phrases it, enclosed in the prison of individualism, end of quote, falsely assuming that character is something you build on your own. His latest book, The Second Mountain, posits instead that good character comes from surrendering to and serving the greater causes of family, community, and belief. David Brooks is a New York Times columnist and a commentator for NPR, PBS, and NBC, and the author of many books, including The Road to Character, The Social Animal, and Bobos in Paradise, and he joins us this hour to talk about his new book, his own moral journey, and what it takes to create joy and meaning in life. And we'll also get his take on Robert Mueller's newly released letter to Attorney General William Barr and Barr's Senate testimony, which is underway as we speak. And welcome back to Forum, Dave.
Great to be here. Always a highlight of my visit to the Bay Area.
Nice of you to say, and certainly a delight to have you here with us again in studio. Let's talk about politics first, though. I mean, you're one of our leading national pundits, and I'm going to lean on you a little bit to get your thoughts about what's going on as we speak here, because Attorney General Barr is testifying and testifying in front of the Senate. We don't know yet whether he's going to testify in front of the House of Representatives, because there's a whole flap over whether he can get counsel in that or not. But there was, as I'm sure you're well aware now, and most of our listeners, I hope, are aware, Washington Post letter that responded to the four-page summary of Attorney General Barr that he put out says he did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of the investigation's conclusions. And that's pretty tough, along with essentially saying it threatened public confidence as well. So that's all out there now, and Barr's got to defend himself, and I'm wondering what you see unfolding here.
Yeah, I had given him the benefit of the doubt when the four-page summary came out, because he did have a very good reputation around Washington. I don't know him, but I know people who know him, and they had high opinion of him.
Despite Iran-Contra?
Yeah, but in general, they had a high opinion of him, and there was no real incentive for him to distort the thing, because it was all going to come out anyway, and he would be exposed as a fabricator. And yet somehow he went ahead and distorted the thing. And for no apparent reason, it's like walking off a cliff. It was bound to be exposed, and he self-immolated. And this is a peculiar feature of the Trump administration. People who had some respectability going into the Trump administration and really polluting their own reputations for a guy they can't possibly respect. I frankly do not understand the psychology behind it.
Well, he was someone who wanted the job. They said, you know, he auditioned for it. He put out the statement about executive power and you can't indict a president and all the rest of that, and defended the president in a way that suggested. And I'm a little bit hazy, and maybe you can help clear this up. But when he stood there and delivered this four-page essentially summary of what was supposed to be a summary of the Mueller report, he was standing next to Rob Rosenstein, who was just resigned and said, I will land the plane to the president. Mm-hmm. And some unnamed figure who looked like one of the Smith brothers from the old cough drops. I still haven't identified who he is. But the reality of this seems to be that, and I had mentioned on the air a couple of times that Barr has a son-in-law who is a Trump attorney, and this is no minor fact, I don't think, but he wanted the job, and he wanted to be Trump's Roy Cohen, as many people have said.
Yeah, well, who would want to be anybody's Roy Cohen, let alone Donald Trump's Roy Cohen? And so why... You know, of all the people who've walked into this administration, and some have done it for the good motives to try to serve the country or at least keep the country safe from this guy, most of them, 99%, have dissoiled themselves. I think of Jim Mattis maybe as somebody who did not, the former Secretary of Defense, and maybe Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador. But they're tucked away in foreign policy. If you're going to be caught up with this guy in anything that refers to Trump himself and his own person, it's either destroy your reputation or quit. And Barr is a mystery to me.
Well, maybe some of our listeners may want to weigh on and help us solve that mystery. But now Lindsey Graham has come out and said, essentially also defended the president, his golfing buddy, but he also made some statements about going after the Hillary Clinton campaign and all the evil deeds that they did.
Yeah, and this is also something I've noticed being around Republican senators, and especially the Republican donor class. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, well, 3 years ago, they all hated Donald Trump and thought he was the worst thing ever to hit the Republican Party or the United States of America. 2 years ago, they felt they had to support him, but privately they loathed him. And now they've sort of swung around, a lot of them, and now they support him, just flat out support him. And it's a psychological transition that's hard for me to understand. But I think the way I see it is they felt for their own political survival they had to support him. And then it's just psychologically too hard to tell yourself privately you despise him and publicly say you like him. And so they give up on their private, actual, honest opinion, and they become their public persona, and they just rationalize it to themselves.
Some have compared this to the Vichys. Is that too much of a stretch?
Yeah, I don't like those kind of comparisons, but it's, you know, the Republican Donald Trump has the base of the party supporting him. And that's just a fact that we have to acknowledge. And it's hard for Republicans to commit career suicide over that. I personally think it's one of those moments where you define yourself.
You, as a former conservative, even a Bill Buckley conservative in previous incarnation, we can talk about your incarnations here because we'll talk about your book. But I was struck by the fact that, and continue to be struck by the fact that many of these conservatives who have lined up behind Trump and for whatever political reasons to save themselves, as you suggest, also have turned around on so many issues. I mean, on the deficit, on trade, on things that were really almost sacred to Republican conservatives.
Yeah, for sure. And I, two things to be said. It's interesting that I have not lost any friends over this because all the people I was close to within the conservative movement turned into never Trumpers, whether it's at National Review or the Weekly Standard, places I've worked. And so there's sort of a writer politico shift. But the one thing I'll defend about Trump, he understood some of the problems we're facing. My line about Trump is he's the wrong answer to the right question. And the plight of rural America, the increasing hostility of the Chinese, these are things he understood. And so there, I think he's doing an awful job as president, but he understood what century we were in, whereas a lot of Republicans were still back trying to revive Reaganism.
This gets us to your book, believe it or not. It's a good segue because, well, when you talk about the first mountain, you know, you're looking for career goals, you're looking for self-status and self-interest and to establish yourself. And then the second mountain becomes much more serving and much more for others, and it goes from kind of me to we. The problem with Donald Trump is there probably is no we in Donald Trump, is there?
Yeah, he's a classic. He's like the parody of the first mountain person. He thinks financial success is the key to fulfillment. He cares only about himself. A narcissist can feel happy when they achieve victory, but narcissists can't experience joy because joy is about self-forgetting. Joy is about when you love your child so much, you just glow in their pleasure. When you love your community so much, you selflessly serve it. And Donald Trump can't be selfless and can't forget himself.
So and can't be happy or experience joy. He seems to be incapable.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem with ego, and he is pure ego. Ego is never enough. If you worship power, you'll always feel powerless because you can never get enough power. If you worship money, you'll always feel poor because you can never get enough money. Our egotistical ambitions, the desires always race out ahead of what we've got. And so it's a life of permanent dissatisfaction. And the other thing, he suffers from pride. And pride is always fragile because nobody's ever treating you as well as you think you should be treated. And so it's just he's like a perfect example of what I think of some of the vices of our culture. And my hope is that we will rebel against it. We often go the opposite way from the last president. And I'm hoping in a weird way he'll contribute to a cultural shift in this country by making us see the dead end that a life of individualism, a life, frankly, based on merit. And financial success, to see that dead end where that ends.
Well, I certainly applaud the hope that you have there, but we're talking about a kind of emptiness, and it goes to the heart of American life, an emptiness that can't be filled, really, aren't we?
Yeah, no, I think, my core diagnosis of what's wrong with us is we have a crisis of social isolation. More people are lonely than ever before. The suicide rate is up 30%. The teenage suicide rate is up 70%. Distrust in each other, distrust in institutions. And basically, we've had 60 years of a highly individualistic culture. And it started out, we needed it. But after 60 years, we've gone to the other extreme and we've chopped out the connections between us. And then we live within the lies of the meritocracy, that you are what you accomplish, that you are a set of skills to be maximized, not a soul to be saved. And the core lie of the meritocracy is that people who have achieved more in the worldly sense are worth slightly more than people who have achieved less.
This, in many ways, though, goes back, at least in my mind as a longtime literature professor, to the idea that we come from Calvinism into earning our rewards by doing the best we can for ourselves and for essentially our own attainment here on earth. And often that's acquisition, that's land, that's property, that's money.
So we've always been capitalistic, we've always been individualistic, but we also had countervailing value systems, whether it was Calvinism, communitarianism, or even socialism. And that is based on the idea that we live not for individual quantitative improvement, we live for qualitative attachments, that we live for our relationships and we're fulfilled by relationships. And it's easy to say you live for relationship. It's hard to actually do. And so in the book, I try to talk about the four big commitments that we make in life, and actually how you serve those commitments, how you serve a family, how you serve your community, how you serve your philosophy, and how you serve your vocation. And it's a tough task to do that, but the life of commitment and service is better than the life of individualism and self-actualization.
What happened to the old rugged individualism? I mean, individualism has come into, I'm reminded of The Culture of Narcissism by Christopher Lash. Right. It's come into a kind of narcissism.
Well, the problem has been diagnosed by people like Christopher Lash and Robert Putnam. There was a book called Habits
Bowling
of the
Alone.
Heart, Bowling Alone. Yeah. And so we've understood the problem of individualism, and it's been diagnosed. And I don't diagnose the problem so much. I try to illustrate a different way of living. And so I've spent the last few years traveling around the country seeing people who just radiate joy. And they've usually had some hard experience in life. They've usually gone into the valley and had a bad experience. And in the valley, the ego doesn't matter. You see how small the desires of the ego are. When you're having one of those tough periods in life, you're either broken or you're broken open. And the broken people get angry and resentful. The broken open people get vulnerable. And they sink down to the level of their heart, the level of their soul, and they get a different set of desires, which are the desire to live in right relationship with others and to serve some transcendent good. And I now can see the difference between first and second mountain people.
This is a good use of pain and suffering is really what you're talking
about. Yeah, I mean, it's horrible to say, but I was with a 94-year-old guy not long ago, and he said, I really have come to see my life is defined by my moments of greatest adversity. And I think in those moments, I think there are two things that we do or it's wise to do. One, you throw yourself on friends. And you have deeper conversation with your friends. You just need them to hold you up at that moment. But you also have to take the pain and stand alone with it and see what it has to teach you. You have to go out into the wilderness where nobody's there to applaud your performance and where the time is different. And you just have to peer deep into yourself and see what the pain has to teach you. Usually it's sort of a ringing bell telling you you've been leading your life somewhat wrongly and how you're going to correct that.
Does the antithesis of individualism, especially a kind of excessive individualism that you're writing about, incline us to think maybe more of a collectivism like socialism? I mean, we've got young legislators now who are moving in that direction. We've got Bernie Sanders, who I think is still second in the polls and believes that he can get the nomination. Is that the antithesis?
Well, that's one antithesis, and I have some respect. I may disagree on this or that thing, but I have some respect for that. I think I've really drawn to people who have devoted themselves locally. And the book is filled with stories of, like, for example, there's a woman named Aisha Butler who was living in Englewood in Chicago, a tough neighborhood there. And she was going to move out because she had a 9-year-old girl. It was violent. The neighborhood, the bullets were flying through her window. And as she was moving out, she looked across the street and saw a vacant lot with two girls, little girls playing with a broken bottle. And she said to her husband, we're not leaving. We're not going to be just another family who abandoned this. And so she Googled volunteer in Englewood, and she started volunteering. And she now is somebody who is knitting the fabric of Englewood together. So it's these decisions not to flee but to commit, and especially on the local level, things we can all do. These are the sort of lifestyle changes and cultural and value changes that we need to get us out of this.
You have some wonderful, inspiring stories here. And again, we're talking to David Brooks, New York Times columnist and Meet the Press and PBS NewsHour commentator. And his new book is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. He's speaking this evening at 7:30 at the Sidney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco and tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. at Dominican University in San Rafael. This is an unusual book for you because there's personal disclosure writing. And what a saga you have had. I mean, I remember you talking about your first marriage and your wife converted from essentially Christianity to Judaism, then became a rabbi and became even more Orthodox as time went on. Yeah. You fell in love with an evangelical woman from Wheaton College and so forth, and now are being more attracted to, I don't know. In fact, let me actually ask you to define where you are. In the book, you talk about being an amphibian, you know, being drawn to Christian architecture and all of these things in your youth. But to many, this sounds like Jew for Jesus apostasy. I don't know. How does it translate?
Just on that, I grew up, I use the joke sexually or religiously bisexual, because I grew up in a Jewish home. But I went to Christian schools and Christian churches and Christian camps for all of my childhood. And so what I saw was Jewish good, which is chesed, it's a loving kindness. The beauty of Jewish life, the core of it is a Shabbat meal, a Friday night meal, where everyone's talking all at once, and they're all correcting the 17 other things they heard, and you just get the togetherness of family. But then in the course of my childhood, I also saw the Christian version of good. I had a friend named Wes Wubenhorst, who was just a man for others. He had this boyish way of talking where it was all full of pops and whistles and enthusiasm, and he lived a life. He became an Episcopal priest. He worked with women who suffer from domestic violence. He went to Honduras and served the poor. And his whole life was just joyous. He was just grateful everything life threw at him. And he walked through that life just irradiating the kind of life that I think we all would want to live. And so I saw these two versions of goodness. And it wasn't a problem for me because I didn't believe in God anyway. So what the heck? There were two just different stories.
And you don't accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?
Yeah, well, I do think the Beatitudes are a great foundation for life. I think the emphasis on the poor in spirit, the emphasis on the meek, the emphasis on the merciful, those who are suffering, it's a great inversion of the lifestyle we have now. And I think in the Beatitudes, some of the celestial grandeur comes through. And so I was living one life, and then I got divorced, and I spent 3 years, really 3 or 4 years living alone in this apartment. In the bottom for me, I tried to substitute lack of relationships for work. And I just lived for writing and for work. My kids had gone off to college. And so it was three tough years where you are, you realize I had weekday friends. I had no weekend friends. I had people I could talk to, politics, go out to lunch.
It's tough in New York, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I live in D.C., but it's...
Oh, that's right. You are in D.C.
And so I, in that period of the wilderness, I did a lot more reading. I went deeper into myself. There's a story the rabbis tell about Moses, who he was being a shepherd, and he had a little lamb that dashed off like a gazelle. And lambs usually don't run like gazelles, but this one did. And Moses had to chase him into the wilderness. And he finally caught them, and the rabbis teach us the lamb is Moses himself. Sometimes you have to endure the suffering to crush your ego, to come into yourself. And so I had a bad 3 years, but then I later fell in love with my current wife. And one of the things I tried to do was build a galaxy of warm places. Places where I could go, where I could really commit myself. So I really was helped saved by a community in D.C. of about 45 young adults, 18 to 22, and about 10 older adults like me. And we have dinner every Thursday night, and we just share everything we have in our lives together. And I go to that table every Thursday, and the kids turn to you like flowers looking for love. And I laugh more on Thursday nights than any other kind of the week. I remember the first time I walked into this home, I met these 40 kids, and I reached out to shake a kid's hand, introduce myself, and the kid said, "We don't shake hands. There's no shaking hands here. We just hug here." And I'm like, not the huggiest guy on the face of the earth.
Joe Biden, maybe.
Maybe Joe Biden is, but I've been hugging with them for the last 6 years.
So you come into a different incarnation or avatar, as I said earlier, and I remember once talking to a Christian theologian who said, the essence of my religion is feed my sheep. And, you know, that's what Jesus really had to teach. And you write about love, and you write about the soul, and you write about happiness and joy. And a lot of people think, is this far afield for David Brooks? Is he moving into different territories here? Is he maybe transforming right before our eyes in print?
Well, I hope I'm getting deeper. I mean, I have a natural tendency toward shallowness. I mean, I'm a reasonably decent communicator, but you can get by on glibness. And so I wrote a book called Bobos in Paradise, which was really about Bay Area consumer culture. And then I wrote a book about called The Social Animal, which I tried to explore emotion. And then The Road to Character was about moral qualities. And this book is really about the inner life. And my view is that American conversation is over-politicized and under-moralized, that we talk a little too much about politics, every poll, every little primary, but we don't talk enough about how to forgive, how to experience life with gratitude, how to make use of seasons of suffering. And this is at the core of our lives. And it's the core of my life, and I think everybody's life. And so we don't have enough public conversation about that. And I think one of my missions that I hope to do is just shift our national conversation a little away from politics and a little about the things that are really 90% of life.
There's a moment in your book which really struck me. In fact, I don't know if you're familiar with the book by Sal Bello called Seize the Day, but sure. There's a moment where the Schlemiel character of his, Tommy Wilhelm, has this feeling of all these souls and the connection to all these souls. You had a kind of mystical moment like that.
Yeah, it happened in Penn Station, the ugliest place on God's green earth. And and this really starts from the work we do, the journalism. When I'm interviewing somebody for a story, I don't think they're just a bag of genetic material. I think they're a soul, and there's some piece of them that has no weight, color, shape, or size, but it gives them infinite value and dignity. Their life has meaning. And slavery is wrong because it's an obliteration of a soul. Rape is not just an attack on a bunch of physical molecules. It's an insult to another person's soul. And so I've come to believe you can believe in God or not believe in God, but I ask you to believe that there are souls. And I was walking in Penn Station one morning, and it's usually a very dehumanizing place. It's a bunch of ants walking through tunnels, basically. And just the awareness came to me that all these people have souls and that we have one story where we talk about how we're doing at work and how our friendships are. But at every moment, our souls are either rising or they're falling. They're being sanctified or they're being degraded. And there's a drama involved in whether we're feeling spiritually well, whether we're feeling emotionally well. And life is really about that drama more than the drama we talk about a lot, which is, how are you doing? How's your vocation going? How's your career going? And I notice this especially with my students. We train them to think about in career terms. We don't train them to think, how do I answer the essential questions in life? There was a study done at the Harvard School of Education. They asked kids in junior high, do your parents care about grades or do they care most about whether you're kind? And 80% of the kids said, they care about my grades. And, you know, when I was a parent, I was sometimes guilty of overemphasizing that too. And so this tries to put words to how do you think about the other stuff.
We are going to be talking to some kids in the next hour. Bay Area teens will be joining us to talk about their experiences, struggling especially with anxiety and depression. And a lot of that comes from, as we've discovered, pressure academically from parents to do well and to pull grades when they don't have necessarily the money some of these stars have to get into the schools that they want to get into. We're talking to David Brooks again, and I'd like to find out your thoughts about that scandal, but what we're going to do here is we're going to move into bringing our listeners aboard. And in fact, I want to invite you now to join us in conversation. Started out talking about the present ongoing Senate and what will perhaps be House of Representative interrogations of Richard Barr, the Attorney General, and talking to David Brooks about his new book, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. Interested in hearing your thoughts, any questions or comments you might have, and you can join us at our toll-free number now, 866-733-6786. Delighted to hear from you. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and there's a lot of research to back up this idea that you can find joy by giving and serving. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with David Brooks. He's a New York Times columnist. He's also with Meet the Press and PBS NewsHour as a commentator and author of a new book called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. And we're talking with him about a number of issues related to his book, an important book in terms of really going into character and a moral life and what it means to really lead a good life, I think, is at the core of what he's dealing with in this book. And just a question before we go to our callers and emailers and so forth, and it has to do with if individualism is still somewhat the norm, all of your examples notwithstanding, and all the good people out there who are trying to serve. I mean, look, I'm in public radio. This is all about public service, right? But how do we get into building community? I mean, particularly with a sense of common purpose. Because individualism, the kind of individualism you're writing about, has become endemic and it's become pervasive everywhere, ubiquitous.
And so, well, so what I talk a lot about the book, a project I've got at the Aspen Institute called Weave, the Social Fabric Project. And the idea behind it is that social isolation is a core problem of fragmentation, but it's being solved on the local level by millions of people. And so we spent the year, and I describe many of the people in the book, traveling around the country, finding people who are leading wonderful lives, lives of service. And some of them are running big organizations. I met a woman in Ohio who... the worst thing happened that can happen to a person. She was out antiquing with her mom. She came home one evening and her husband had killed their kids and himself. And she now runs a free pharmacy. She helps mothers who have had violence in their family. She teaches at Ohio University. She's living a life of service. And she said, I did it because I was angry. Whatever that guy tried to do to me, he's not going to do it. I'm going to make a difference in the world. And so these are dramatic examples. But most people, it's not that dramatic. There's a woman in Florida who was helping elementary school kids across the street after school. And she was asked, do you have any time to volunteer? And she said, no, I don't have time to volunteer. And he said, well, are you getting paid for helping the kids across the street? And she said, no. And then he said, well, what are you doing this afternoon? And she says, well, I always bring food to the hospital for the sick. And she doesn't see that as volunteering. She just sees that as what neighbors do. And so part of what has to happen is that we have to redefine what being a neighbor really means. And when I go and visit with these weavers, they're leading us in a better way. They're a movement that doesn't know it's a movement. And social change happens when a small group of people find a better way to live and the rest of us copy them.
There's some wonderful people out there, some loving people, and you portray their lives in ways that are really palpable. What I was talking about, I didn't mean to sound cynical about this, but you even write about the loss of neighborhoods. And so to build community and to really foster the kind of things that you're talking about here, I mean, we've become so much more secular that it's difficult not to have the churches and synagogues moving us in that direction. Yeah. And, you know, that's what they traditionally did.
Right. But we just need to build new institutions. And so in Shreveport, Louisiana, it's a very racially divided city, very economically divided city. But there's an organization called Community Renewal International. And of the 250,000 people in Shreveport, 55,000 volunteer in this organization. On every block, there's sort of a host family that organizes social life for the neighborhood so they know when things are going well and when things are not. And, for example, libraries are really inventing themselves, and they're becoming community hubs.
Places for the homeless, for example.
Yeah, but they have outreach in a million different ways. It's kind of inspiring what libraries have done, and it makes a real difference in the world. There was a sociologist named Eric Kleinenberg who studied a heat wave in Chicago, and two neighborhoods side by side. In one neighborhood, a lot of elderly people died in that heat wave. In the other, none died. What was the difference? There were things like libraries where people could get to know each other, and so that when the heat wave came, they checked up on the old people. And in other neighborhoods, they didn't have those institutions, and nobody was there to check up on them.
Which reminds me of the fact that people often act in an altruistic or in a giving and serving way in the face of disaster. I mean, it's been clocked time and again and characterized by, I think of Katrina, for example, yeah. Suddenly people not only within the community but outside of the community.
Yeah. Social science has done us a lot of harm. And economists have given us a view of human nature, which is that we're utility-maximizing individuals who make choices. We're not. We're born into relationships. We're formed in relationships. The people I meet, and I find most people, they're driven by a desire to do some good in the world. Why you went to public radio or, you know, why these people do community service. Because that's where we have a moral motivation. And so the people I meet, they just want to feel they're making some difference in the world, and they let their soul shape their lives.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say or ask, and we begin, David, with you. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thanks so much for the program. It struck me when you were talking about social isolation that my wife comes from a country and culture where the extended families live in essentially family compounds. They all have their own house, but they're right next to each other. And you get this really rich dynamic of interconnectedness, and there can certainly be dysfunction. But it seems like what you're describing is sort of different ways of replacing that in a culture where, you know, I live an hour from my parents and people think, well, that's really close. But it's such a contrast to the traditional connectedness of family. I wonder if you think that's something that it's worth trying to recapture, or you think we can replace adequately with the sort of structures you're describing now. But it strikes me as the way that we used to do this.
Yeah, that's the way humanity has lived. And we've sort of divided ourselves into small nuclear families, isolated from one another and isolated from neighborhoods. And most of the world is not like that. An Israeli woman told me this story. Her husband called in one day when he was traveling, she was on the phone. When she got off the phone, it was like 10 p.m. She went to check on the 4-year-old son. He wasn't in his bed. She ran around the house. She couldn't find him. She checked the pool. She couldn't find him. And so she's frantic at this point. And she's running around the street calling out his name. And some lights go on in the houses, but nobody comes out. And then she goes back, and it turns out he'd built a little fort for himself in the living room under some pillows and had fallen asleep. And then the next day, some neighbor said, "Well, why were you screaming your son's name in the street?" And she said, "What kind of country is this? In Israel, everybody would have been coming out on the street in their pajamas looking for the kid." But people withdraw into the domestic privacy. And this is one of the pieces of our culture. We value privacy over community. And to have community, you have to give up a little privacy. But I found
that also overcome fears. I mean, sometimes somebody screaming in the street, you don't necessarily want to go there.
But if you hear a mom screaming your son's name, it seems to me you go out in the street. But that impulse has become detached from us. You can be morally detached.
Let me thank the caller. Go right to another caller, and that's you, Marie. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for talking with me. Hey, David. Thank you so much for everything you've done over the last few years. I really have always listened to you and read your articles. When the Trump administration came into being, I was kind of looking to your writings for answers. And when I see you talking about your morality and the, you know, merit-based society and the value of that vis-a-vis our lives these days, I'm just wondering, it doesn't seem to square with the conservatism that you've had in the past and with government programs. So for me, when you talk about souls and animals, I mean, sorry, you talk about souls and people being an individual soul, I don't see why you're not pulling that into a bigger perspective of maybe like the Green New Deal or working toward the planet, you know, giving that as a society's a way for us all to work together to a community-based way to improve the world that works on our individual souls. I just don't understand why your economics or the conservatism that you've had, why you're not being pulled in this new direction, or maybe you are.
Maria, thank you for the call. We'll hear from David Brooks.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent my life, and if you read my writings and read my books, you'll see I've spent my entire life talking about early childhood education, talking about public education, talking about nurse-family partnerships, talking about national service programs. And I may not agree with the Green New Deal. And I have some suspicion of that much centralization of power in Washington. But surely we can say you can try to lead a moral life even if we have different disagreements about the Green New Deal. And one of the things, frankly, I found in this tour is the reduction of all of life to political position taking. And most of life is how we treat each other, how we serve our communities, how we do relationships, whether we're willing to be vulnerable with each other, whether we're willing to show up when people are suffering. And that stuff is the core of morality. Now, and not whether you take a certain position on one issue. And so I'm a conservative because I believe in the concept of epistemological modesty, which is society's really complex. And when we do change, we should be modest about how much we can know. And therefore, we should do change constantly, but sort of gradually and carefully. And my conservatism is nothing like the conservatism of the Republican Party. It goes back to Edmund Burke in the 18th century. But I do think it's a very valid philosophy, and I've met many great people who have that philosophy. I've met many great people who have a more progressive philosophy. And the quality of our moral life is determined by how we do, not, frankly, by how we vote or how we what positions we happen to take on the Green New Deal, for example.
Well, here's Ken, who says, "I hope now that David Brooks has realized the problems of individualism, he will renounce his associations with conservative political philosophy and the Republican Party, which seeks to impose crass individualism on our nation through their cruel politics."
Yeah, well, I never was a Republican, and I think I've spent since 1995 at least being very distant from the Republican Party. And again, let's not make politics a religion here. Religion is religion. Humanity is religion. Belief in humanistic ideals, belief in reason these are the things, these are the creeds that really matter. And so I've found myself having to distance myself from the Republican Party and from the people who call themselves conservatives because I don't share their political values. And in this president, I don't share their moral values and their values about race. And I find them highly offensive.
Where does the role of government come into this, especially social and economic change that you're kind of
Yeah, what government can do, government can't provide care. Only people can provide care. But government can provide service. So there can be service to those who are less well off. And there can be platforms. There can be. And one of the things you notice about societies that really, I think, are doing well is they have very generous welfare states in Scandinavia. But they also, in order to be able to afford those welfare states, they have relatively open economies with a lot of free trade. And so we have this debate, big government versus small government. But if you look at the societies that are really doing well, the Denmarks, the Swedens, they have both. They have free markets, but they also have generous welfare states. And to me, that cuts crossways to the stale debate we've been having and suggests we should do something in that scale. There should be a lot more support for those who are the victims of the rising inequality. But we should also think about the dynamism of our economy, which is a treasure that we sometimes take for granted. And so I'm for open trade and relatively open borders because I want that dynamism so that we can pay for mutual support for each other.
Again, our guest is David Brooks. His new book is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. And we'll go to more of your calls. Rob joins us next. Rob, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. And thank you for being on, David. I really enjoy listening to what you've been saying. It makes me think about just it feels like there's such a lack of kindness and just general common courtesy people to each other at just the local level, the driving, you know, the way people drive now, they cut you off and then they flip you off. Everybody's in a rush to try to get ahead and everybody's detached because of the internet or whatever you want to blame it on. But I've decided to try to pay it forward when I go to the store and maybe the clerk is a little cranky because they're rushed. To just be nice to them as a person and look at them when you talk to them and try to do little things along the way and hope that maybe it catches on, that person, you know, subconsciously feels just a little bit better after that interaction and try to make it a contagious thing where we're nice to each other again and try to turn this around.
It's a nice philosophy,
in the
Rob.
Face of Trump.
Let me hear what David Brooks has to say. He's talking about just genuine acts of ordinary kindness.
Yeah, and that actually does matter. It may sound like banal and easy, but it really does matter. If you ask people a generation ago, do you trust your neighbors? 60% said, yeah, I trust my neighbors. The people around me are trustworthy. Now it's down to 32% and 19% of millennials. And so social distrust means you say, oh, I can only count on myself. And social distrust arises because people are untrustworthy. People are cruel to each other. People are rude. People are getting cut off. You just live in this atmosphere where I can't trust the people around me. And it's especially harsh on the young. You said you have teenagers coming on. The most alarming social statistic in our society right now, to me, well, one of the most anyway, is the teenage suicide rate has gone up 70% in the last several years, 70%. And part of that is people feeling alone. Part of that is the pressure of the meritocracy. Part of it is technology. When we talk to and communicate through text and Instagram and Twitter, it's not real communication. It's not communication that flows out of our heart and soul. It's out of our ego. It's look how great my life is or look how stupid you are. And if you
look how many Twitter followers
right.
I have.
And so it's all ranking. And so if you are stuck in that world, it's going to be hard for you. I ran into a psychologist last week who I was asking her, why is the teenage suicide rate just skyrocketing? And she said, a lot of my patients, they have many different personas that they put out into social media, but none of them are their real persona. And so they're sort of emptied out or they're just insecure in themselves and they're fearful. And so we have just a lot of fear, a lot of trauma in my travels around the country, stunned by how much trauma there is, and stunned every time I mention in a speech or at a meeting teenage suicide rate, somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, I lost a child, I lost a son when he was 14, I lost a daughter when she was 16. It is just pervasive in our society right now.
As I said, we'll be talking to some teenagers in the hour ahead. We're talking now with David Brooks, and his new book, again, is called The Second Mountain. And let me get another caller aboard here. Sarah, that's you. We welcome you. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking this call, and thank you for everything you both do. I just wanted to ask how to help guide two teenage sons and their moral compass, because I hear everything you're saying, and I have lived a life of service, although not as old as some. My parents did the same in Santa Rosa, California, and my mom taught me that life in America was built on the backs of volunteers. And I want my sons to know that the moral compass is far more important in giving back to the community versus worrying about those grades to get them into college, worrying about what they're going to be doing for their life, how much money they're going to make, and how in giving back to the community is far more enriching for their life and will lead them further. And so how do I help them as one son and I and our family are about to embark in getting him into college? How do I help him find that compass versus worrying so much about what college he's going to get in and what...
Sarah, there's almost a kind of pleading in your voice. How do I help my son? And David Brooks, can you come to the aid here?
Well, the first thing you're doing is you're pouring love into him. So that's the most important thing you're doing. He now has a model for what love feels like. And because you did that, he'll be able to do that. Or they, both of your sons will be able to do that. I try to focus my students on the big questions in life. Our society seems to be a conspiracy to get us focus on the unimportant things and to ignore the important things. And most of our lives have four big commitments. We make a commitment to our family. We make a commitment to a career. We make a commitment to a philosophy or faith and to our community. And so those are these are the big decisions your sons are going to be making. And they're just questions about how do you make those decisions well and then how do you commit well. And so I, with my students where I teach, I try to get them to focus, like, how do you choose a marriage partner? What questions you should ask? And so, for example, I say a marriage is a 50-year conversation, ideally. So choose someone you can talk to forever. Choose someone who is kind. We don't think about kindness as a very sexy quality, but kindness is really what you should go for in choosing a marriage partner, not neuroticism. And then I give them examples of people who have found their vocation, how they do their job and how they find their job. And often these examples are very aesthetic. Annie Dillard asked a painter, how'd you become a painter? And she said, I just love the smell of paint. And Einstein, when he was four, his father gave him a compass and he saw the invisible forces of the universe. And he said, I'm in love with that. And so what I try to do in the book is hold up examples that are meant to uplift and inspire and set a high standard, maybe higher than we'll live up to. But if we set high standards for what a really good life looks like, we'll be inspired by those standards and we'll come a little closer to them. And let's face it, I wrote this book partly for myself. Writers are working out their stuff in public, trying to kick their own rear ends to be a better person. And then you try to share it. There's a good saying about writing. It's we're beggars who tell other beggars where we found bread.
How less shallow are you now? You said it was in your DNA.
Yeah, well, you know, I think I'm less shallower than I was 15 years ago. I've been through a lot and try to live up to the standards that I put in the book. I'm in sort of the foothills of my second mountain. I'm not at the top the way I see other people.
Here's another political comment I want to get your response to. This is a listener who writes, so now a defender of conservatism and the Republican Party, he said he wasn't a Republican, but that promotes rugged individualism is now saying we don't do it alone. From what I have heard so far, I think he is still talking about only a certain type of family, community, and belief. What does he now think about past social programs like Medicare and Social Security and the new push to socialize health insurance for all? That is caring for the community as a whole.
Yeah, people fix on this label conservative. And I'm an Edmund Burke conservative, but I should not be confused with libertarian. I've spent my entire life combating this. And when you work at the Times, which has a mostly left-wing readership, you're struck by the power of a label. And frankly, sometimes I feel nobody actually reads anything I've written over the last 30 years just because there's this label conservative. And so they think, oh, he's Ann Coulter. I've spent my life not being Ann Coulter. And so the power of this label to distort reality, it's frankly a product of the tribal times in which we live, in which we label other people and then think we know everything about them.
Tribalism has become so much more ascendant, and you say what about that?
Yeah, well, I think when you leave people naked and alone, they do what their evolutionary roots tell them to do, which is they revert to tribe. And tribe seems like a way to get community. It seems like a way to bond, but it's actually the opposite of community. Community is based on mutual affection for something, for a town, for a cause, whatever. Tribalism is based on mutual hatred of another. And it's based on a scarcity mentality that life is a zero-sum struggle. It's us versus them, kill or be killed, distrust, combat, build walls, erect barriers. And we have a lot of tribalism in our politics. And some of it, a lot of it is what elected Donald Trump. But if I could be blunt here, if you just put a label on someone conservative and therefore decide that everything they say should be banished, to me that's a form of conservatism. We can be a little more subtle than this, that there are people of all stripes. And so Edmund Burke, my hero, was just a wonderful man. He was a good man to his sons. He was a good man to his country. He did not. He went against party. Sometimes he really supported the American Revolution. He really opposed the French Revolution, driven by creed. And so he's someone I admire. Alexander Hamilton is my other hero. And he believed in creating a country where poor boys and girls like him could rise and succeed. And he, most of the, through history, has been called a conservative. But that label distorts and blinds you to who he really was.
Just a quick word about conservatism. When I began in public radio, I would have people on from Hoover, which at that time had a strong and merited reputation as being a conservative institution. And I would get a lot of blowback. What are you putting these fascists on and that sort of thing? I said, even if you feel that way, and I made this a public statement, I just want to hear what these people have to say. So, you know, you can, if you want to oppose them, you know where they're standing and what you can glean from them would be useful to you. I still stand by that. Let me get another caller on. Is it Meira?
Yes, Meira.
Meira, sorry, go ahead. You're on
Hello,
the air.
Hello, David. I do read your columns, and I enjoy them. I'm a rabbi, and I was distressed to hear you characterize love and Judaism as getting together Friday night for Shabbat dinner and everybody interrupting each other. There's so much more, and I wouldn't count that as part of love and Judaism. What I would count is visiting the sick, caring for mourners, caring for people at death and after death and at birth, and working in community.
Maybe, Rabbi, maybe there's a distinction. It was made by Philip Roth, but the difference between Judaism and Jewishness. I think maybe you were talking, David Brooks, more about Jewishness.
Rabbi is right. What I said, trying to summarize it, I was talking too quickly, giving a quicker answer. And Judaism is all that. To me, Judaism, you know, I am a Jew. I was born a Jew. I feel a Jew. My people are the Jewish people. To me, it's living into a story. And to me, it is the story in the Torah. It's the five books. But it's mostly, to me, it's Exodus. Exodus is about how God formed a group of disparate ex-former slaves into a people. And we live out that story, and it becomes true. When Jews came to this country, we lived out that story. When Jews returned to Israel, they lived out that story. And in living out the story, we conform to an underlying moral reality of the universe, which is, to me, described in the Bible. And that would, you know, again, it's hard in a quick conversation to have some fulsome description of a many thousand-year-old faith and people. But to me, it is a story that is the ground of our being.
I have to ask you if you're familiar with archaeologist named Israel Finkelstein, who is a professor at the University of Tel Aviv, who has caused great controversy in Israel and beyond because he says archaeological data does not support the Exodus.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of that. And I would say I really don't know whether there were Jews in Egypt and whether they actually marched across the Sinai. But I know that there's a great book called The Particulars of Splendor by Aviva Zornberg, which I highly recommend. And she says this is about moral formation. This book is about, Exodus is about moral formation, how people come into themselves so they can be ready to embark on a covenant. And whether there was actually a physical march, whether they actually did the stuff that's in the movie with Charlton Heston, I don't know. But I do know that story captures the human condition in a way that is deep and is real, and maybe more real than just a historical event that is eternally real.
Can you be a messianic Jew? Can you accept the divinity of Jesus Christ when indeed Judaism has always waited for the Messiah, and so the Messiah has not come?
Yeah, I don't really know anything about messianic Jews, and I don't like feel I'm one. But I do, you know, as I said, I grew up in this dual childhood, and I really came to do Jewish rituals through life and such. But when I read the Sermon on the Mount, that feels also just part of celestial grandeur. It feels like a way to organize life. And I can't unread that. I don't want to shut that off.
I also read your column about ritual. You're a big fan of ritual.
Yeah, ritual is how we mark transitions in life. And we don't do enough of it. Jews actually do a lot of it. I mentioned in that column that there are 613 mitzvah, and most of them have to do with lighting candles and doing some kind of ritual. Rituals are physical ways we can mark the transitions in life, and we don't have enough of them. We should have a ritual for when somebody comes out of prison and we welcome that into the community. There should just be a ritual when somebody moves into your neighborhood, you have a barbecue. These things should be marked by rituals, and a life unstructured by ritual is a life that where you wander through it without marking the phases.
Quick question. How does working for the benefit of one's kids come into this? By that, I mean, it's difficult moral ground given society's inequality and things like education, opportunity.
How does working for one's kids? Or
yeah, working for one's children.
Yeah. Well, I do think...
On behalf of one's children.
Right. I think most of us are powerfully motivated for work for our kids. We're sort of biologically driven and emotionally driven to do that. I do think sheltering one's kids from some of the pressures of larger society... And a lot of that is technology. I have a friend who, he's got rituals around the use of technology. So before he looks at a screen every morning, he goes outside and looks at the sky. That's his ritual. But with technology, he and his family observe these patterns, a Sabbath, that 1 hour a day, 1 day a week, and I think 1 week or 1 month a year, no screens. And that's a way to center your family's life and center your children's lives on things that are creative.
We'll leave it there. David Brooks, always good to have you.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. David Brooks, again, is New York Times columnist, Meet the Press and PBS NewsHour commentator, and his new book is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. He's going to be speaking this evening at the Commonwealth Club at 7:30 at the Sydney Goldstein Theater this evening and tomorrow evening at the Dominican University in San Rafael at 6 p.m. As I said, we're going to be talking to some teenagers next. Stay tuned for that. We're going to be talking about what they have to contend with anxiety and depression and more. And David brought up these depressing numbers of suicides. We'll find out what can be done. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.